From CAFE, welcome to CAFE Insider. I'm Preet Bharara.
And I'm Ann Milgram.
How are you, Ann?
Hey, Preet. How are you?
I'm good. Same. You? You got some time last week?
Yeah. We took a few days off and just did some little trips, day trips. We went to Sandy Hook State Beach in State Park in New Jersey. And
wonderful.
Then we went to Storm King, the outdoor sculpture garden in New York State. And that was also amazing. And so, and we played a lot of family soccer and went to the beach. It was great.
Sounds great. Did you catch any of the DNC last week?
I did. Actually, you know, it was great because a lot of nights, I don't know if you feel this way, and some of our listeners probably feel the same, but a lot of nights I'm working now. I mean, there's sort of, it feels a little relentless some days. And so it was really nice taking a lot of last week off. You know, I thought it was really well done. I think it's really different than an in-person convention, but I, you know, found it really engaging. And how about you? I think...
Yeah, I thought it was well done also. You know, there was a lot of emotion packed into a lot of the days.
And I was laughing at all the people talking about how many times they cried during the DNC. I'm someone who, you know, I could cry at a commercial, so I'm a pretty low bar, but I did think parts were emotional for sure.
And then what about the first night of the RNC? We're recording this on Tuesday morning. I will say, as I think I tweeted last night, I'm a little hard of hearing after hearing Kimberly Guilfoyle scream at me for 15 minutes.
Ladies and gentlemen, leaders and fighters for freedom and liberty and the American dream, the best is yet to come.
Yeah, I mean, I did catch that. And you sort of couldn't miss it also on social media and the news because it was everywhere. And I think part of it is it's probably really weird to be giving a speech like that in an empty room, but it was also a choice that she made to be sort of, you know, bombastic and really loud. And it felt off to me. But, you know, I have to also say that someone said today about the convention, if you were asking questions like, why is this happening? It's clear that, you know, it wasn't intended for you, right? That sort of like... You and I were not the audience to understand.
I don't think it was intended for anyone who has normal hearing, actually. And the weird thing, when it's an empty, usually you would think you would default to being more quiet because there's no one to project to.
And also,
I think it got louder over time. I want to commend you on your use of bombastic. I think that's an underused word.
Thank you.
And it makes me think of the Shaggy song. Do you know it?
Yeah, of course.
She called me Mr. Bombastic, friendly, fantastic, touchman on my box, she says I'm Mr. Rule.
What did you think of last night, other than it being loud?
So I thought Guilfoyle was ridiculous, but I thought there were effective speeches. I don't agree with things, but if you think about what their purpose was, Nikki Haley is a very, very effective speaker and communicator.
Yep.
There was the gentleman from Cuba.
He was effective, I thought.
He was very effective, and he had good
volume. That's
not
to say that I agree with him at all, but I think as far as
speakers go, I think you have to examine these things and
yes.
See who is effective and who's not effective, and I thought he was. But I think overall, there was a debate about the Democrats having Republicans there, but they also had very, very progressive Democrats there, you know, kind of big tent. It looks like they're trying to reach out to people beyond the natural base that Joe Biden would have. Republican side, that did not seem to be the case. Well, I also thought, by the way, Tim Scott is a really good speaker and really effective and presents the case better than Donald Trump does.
One thing that's interesting is that I was sort of thinking about this last night. It felt like there were more traditional Republicans almost at the Democratic convention than there were at the Republican convention. So there's like this omission, which is who would you expect to see on the first night of a Democratic convention? Like, you know, we saw Bill Clinton, former Democratic president. We saw Hillary Clinton, Democrat presidential candidate, like every one of Biden's rivals. We saw Barack Obama, of course, gave a president who preceded President Trump. And you would have expected to see George W. Bush. You would have expected to have seen a lot of the sort of stalwarts of the Republican Party, and they weren't there. Right. So Nikki Haley is sort of a recent, you know, she was the governor of South Carolina, but she's pretty, you know, people have thought of her as an up and comer. But Tim Scott, same. Like they're like the sort of core people that you would have expected to have seen were not there. And do you think it's because they weren't asked or do you think it's because they said no?
I think both. I think depending on the person, I think it was both. So look, we got 3 more days to go. So, you know, there's another terrible event over the weekend, and we talked about this when it happened with George Floyd, and it sparked a lot of protest, and it's going to happen again. A young 29-year-old unarmed black man, Jacob Blake, was shot 7 or 8 times, depending on the report, in the back by police officers in Kenosha, Wisconsin. We don't have all the facts. We don't have the names of the police officers, as far as I can tell. But based on the video, which is brutal to watch, it looks inexcusable. It doesn't make any sense. Another tragic fact is that Jacob Blake's 3 young children were in the backseat of the car. He was shot. We should note, this doesn't justify any of the action that was taken, but police had their guns drawn. Blake looked like he was not following their instructions, and he seeks to get back into his car, and then he's shot at point-blank range in the back. And his father has reported that Blake, though alive and stable, is paralyzed from the waist down.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's both an individual tragedy for Blake and his family, but it just begs the question in this larger national conversation we're having of why the police are shooting, killing, and injuring unarmed black men in this way. And you cannot watch that video, in my view, having led a police agency and overseen more than 30,000 police officers, and believe that the police acted correctly, in my view. You know, the idea that you would shoot someone in the back because they're not complying with a lawful order, it's not the way it works, and it's not the way it should ever work. And so I think, you know, as people have started to stop paying as much attention to the Black Lives Matter protests that are still going on around the country, and there are some that are going to take place, I think, in Washington, D.C. later this week. But as people start to sort of lose interest and look away, the bottom line is that you see this and you understand why people are still protesting, why we haven't even really begun in some ways to have the conversation we need to have about how do we stop this from happening. And it also speaks to me, Preet, of a larger problem, which is that I promise you that almost every police chief in America, the last thing in the world they want is for any of their officers to be involved in any of these shootings. So I would guess that most of them are saying, like, don't draw your weapon unless you absolutely have, like, basically be as careful as you possibly can be. And if, you know, try to de-escalate violence. And you look at something like this, and this was an escalation by the officer. No question about it.
And the irony is, again, all of this reporting is new and is fluid, and we're recording this on Tuesday, August 25th in the 10 a.m. hour. So by the time you listen to this, there may be more facts that come out that contradict some of this. But the reporting is that Blake was there to de-escalate a domestic incident himself.
Between two women who were fighting, right?
Yeah.
Yep. And again, you know, we need to know more about it, but it's really, it just raises this question of structurally, can we change policing the way that we started the conversation to talk about it? Or do we have to move to do things that are far more drastic because the institutions themselves are not able to stop this kind of conduct from happening? And I think it's a really important conversation that needs to be happening.
What's remarkable to me about it, and is kind of disconcerting and disappointing, is that you would think that an individual officer in the country right now, in the wake of George Floyd and other people, but particularly George Floyd, and how much reaction there has been, that a police officer has in their mind this thought, I don't want to be the next person to engage in that kind of brutality that's, you know, inexcusable. And yet you have this off, and it's unclear if it was one officer or two officers who shot at this point. You know, notwithstanding all the publicity, notwithstanding all the new training, notwithstanding all the criticism, this officer, when there were opportunities to de-escalate or to maybe even if they thought they needed to, take Jacob Blake into custody before he reaches his car, he shoots anyway. So it's kind of upsetting to think that among other things that should cause people to have pause is the publicity and universal condemnation of what happened to George Floyd. It still happens.
Right. I mean, and that's my point, is that even individually knowing is a terrible thing to do. Institutionally, having a police chief say it's a terrible thing to do, it's still happening. And I would suggest that folks watch, just for an example of like the counterfactual of how this can be done. There's a great video, and this is one of countless examples, and I'm sorry to always like hold up Camden, but it's really worth seeing with them. The man who's mentally ill, he has a knife, and basically the police officers follow him down the street. They ultimately disarm him, and it ends without any violence. But it is a classic thing to watch, that the officers have countless opportunities, and he's armed, remember, whereas Blake, there's no evidence at all that he was armed or that the police believed he was armed, at least from what we know at this moment in time. And again, the other individual in Camden was a threat to other people more directly than Blake, it looked like, was trying to leave. So when you counterbalance that and you watch that video and you see that the police officers acted strategically, tactically, they had proper training, they surrounded him, but they did so in a way that was safe to them and that basically stopped him from being able to hurt somebody else. And eventually, it goes on for like 9 minutes. He basically relents, he drops his knife, and he's taken into custody. And so the idea that there's only one way to do this and that it involves using a service weapon and shooting someone to stop them from getting in a car to leave. And the only other thing I'd say, Preet, is like, I imagine, and you know, we don't want to fill in the blanks here. We obviously want Blake and to be able to speak for himself. And, you know, I hope to God that he's well enough and recovers. But there is this point of, you know, he's also been watching the news. He's also been watching Derek Chauvin murder George Floyd. And so the police officer is telling him to stop. He doesn't think he's doing anything unlawful, right? And there really is, like, for the police officers to actually use force to stop you, it can't just be that they want to talk to you, right? That they have to have a higher level of suspicion. And so he basically is probably thinking in his mind, like, this is going to go badly. Like, I don't want to have this interaction with the police. Like, it's potentially dangerous to me.
Yeah, well, if they detain me, look, George Floyd wasn't shot. George Floyd was detained and put on the ground with Chauvin putting his knee in the back of his neck. And that's what killed him. And so, yeah, maybe Blake was like, this is not going to go well for me if I obey, because it didn't go well for Floyd.
And I'm not saying here that he shouldn't comply with a lawful police order. I think what it says to me is that there's a huge issue of legitimacy, meaning that a large portion of the population is going to be fearful of complying with a police command because they have seen what happens to people who do.
Noncompliance is not a better option, as we see.
Also. No. Look,
the officers are going to argue, I suspect, that they weren't trying to prevent him from leaving, but rather, I mean, this is just a hypothesis of mine. They were going to say he went into his car and we didn't know if he was reaching for a gun.
If he had a weapon. Exactly. Exactly.
And once he's going in the car, maybe he was going for the glove compartment. That's all speculative, but there was no reason based on the video that I saw that it should have gotten to the point where he walks around to the side of the car. And by the way, they're firing shots with three kids in the backseat of the car.
Right.
So any action that taken should have been away from the automobile, it seems to
Yes.
me.
Yes.
Anyway, I'm sure a lot of facts will develop. I don't know. I don't know if you've seen reports whether there were body cams on the
I don't
the
believe
officers.
That there were body cams. At least if there were, they have not been released. And remember, this is a pretty small city. I don't know if they had body cams. I do think that one of the things we're seeing is that when people have cell phones and they take these videos and these audios, it completely changes the national conversation. And it's a different level of accountability that, I mean, it is one of the best advertisements for both body cams and police dash cams that record everything and requiring the officers to park, you know, basically with a view. So you've got multiple cameras. And also, if you have a lot of cities, and I don't think this is one of them, but a lot of major cities have CCTV set up basically for crime fighting purposes, that also needs to be used in these cases to be capturing and holding account officers accountable for misconduct.
I understand that two of the officers have been placed on administrative leave. Again, we're talking about this early on Tuesday. Maybe the facts will change by the time you listen to this, and we'll be obviously looking at this closely and talking about it next week, I'm sure.
Yes.
So last week, we spent most, if not all, of our time talking about the U.S. Postal Service and the Postmaster General, about whom much has been said. Louis DeJoy appeared at two hearings. Last Friday, he appeared in the Senate, and yesterday, Monday, August 24th, he appeared before the House Oversight Committee. Did we learn a lot from Mr. DeJoy, Anne?
Well, we did not learn that much aside from learning that he actually doesn't know nearly as much about the agency he runs as you would expect. And let's break that down in a minute. But remember that after we taped on Tuesday, the Postmaster General made a statement saying, I'm going to delay the changes. He didn't say he was going to undo the changes he had made since he came into office in June, but he basically said, I'm going to hit pause. I think you might have talked about that a little bit. And you've
I had to, because it kind of undid some of what we talked about, I recorded
that's
a disclaimer
right.
while I had no power. Power went out in my house.
That's right. That's right. And so we then came into Friday's hearings with the Senate, basically with this idea of, okay, DeJoy is going to explain what's happened and what hasn't happened. The things that I think are worth noting are, number one, that even though he's committed, you know, he said he's committed to prioritizing ballots, but he wasn't willing to go back and undo the work that he'd been done, that has been done, the things like taking sorting machines out of commission. He did stop them from taking away other mailboxes, but he did not commit to putting them back in the place where they were before. And what also has come out is that there really have, if you just look at the numbers, the mail delay really does correlate almost exactly with his starting in office. And so what troubled me about the hearings, and particularly yesterday's hearings, is that he said, he basically blamed other people for all of it and said, you know, stopping overtime was in the works for a long time. I didn't do it. He was asked by Representative Katie Porter who did it. And he said, I don't know. I mean, it just sort of, it just belies like credibility for him to be up there as the head of the agency.
He said a couple of positive things. I don't know how much to credit him, but he did say he supports mail-in voting. He also did say, quote,
as we head into the election season, I want to assure this committee and the American public that the Postal Service is fully capable and committed to delivering the nation's election mail securely and on time.
He said that before the Senate. There's a big difference between words and deeds, though.
Yes. But one other thing he did also say that I think was important is that as a rule, and again, it's like, you know, you don't get points for doing the right thing, but it's still welcome news. For years, the Postal Service has treated ballots, absentee ballots, whether they're being mailed or being sent in, as first-class mail, even if someone hasn't paid for that level of service, that level of speed. And then this year they said for the first time that they were not going to do that, that if you bought sort of bulk mail rate to mail out an absentee ballot, a mail-in vote, voter ballot, that they would not treat that as first class, which had been the practice. So he also reversed on that and said that anything election related, they'll treat as first class mail, which should mean that it gets delivered more quickly. So that was also positive. Again, he's the one that made that change to sort of put that in jeopardy. So I don't know how many points we should be giving him for going back to what was the status quo. But it's still important to note that there's been a lot of public pressure. People love the post office. People need to get mail, medication. And this was a victory in some sense that it did appear, at least to me, I don't know what you thought, it did appear to me that like the scrutiny has made a difference. And he's stepping back from some of the more drastic changes. The problem still to me, though, Preet, is like he basically said, like, we'll authorize overtime as necessary. Well, who gets to decide what's necessary? And there's just so many pieces that feel to me like, you know.
Yeah, I worry that he said what he needed to say to sort of save himself. And some of the rhetoric was good, but the proof is in the pudding, as they say. And look, and on sort of concrete measures, he flatly refused to do certain things, like Democratic Representative Stephen Lynch said, will you replace the 600 some odd sorting machines that had been removed? And he just said flatly, no, I will not putting them back. And I don't quite understand why not, if they're capable of handling huge amounts of mail in an efficient way.
Another thing that was troubling to me is that when Representative Katie Porter, and you know, we talked about it, she said she was coming prepared, and she definitely did come prepared. She asked him, you know, how many vote by mail ballots were there in the last election?
Yeah, so Anne, we previewed what we thought would be the case when Katie Porter came time to ask her questions. As you said, she said she came prepared. And afterwards, she tweeted, spoiler, DeJoy did not. And I think we should actually showcase some of the back and forth between Porter and DeJoy. Do you want to play the part of Representative Katie Porter?
Anne? I would prefer that part, yes. If I get to choose, yes.
You know, next casting. Time we do this, I want to play the good guy.
Okay, we'll swap. What is the cost of a first-class postage stamp?
55 cents.
What about to mail a postcard?
I don't know.
We're getting
to the laughing challenge early.
What if I want to mail one of those greeting cards that's a square envelope?
I'll submit that I know very little about a postage stamp.
Do you know about within a million or so? Can you tell me how many people voted by mail in the last presidential election?
No, I cannot.
To the nearest 10 million?
I would be guessing, and I don't want to guess.
Okay, so Mr. DeJoy, I am concerned. I'm glad you know the price of a stamp, but I am concerned about your understanding of this agency. Could you please tell me who did order these changes if you as Postmaster General did not? If you did not order these actions to be taken, please tell the committee the name of who did.
I do not know.
That about summarizes.
Case closed.
That about summarizes, you know, how it went. And I think the issue here to me is it's just, first of all, it's incredible to me that you would show up for a hearing like this and not be prepared on all of those things. But put all that aside just for a second about, you know, terrible government service where the people should demand and expect a higher level of knowledge. The problem is that, you know, if he'd come in and just started running an agency in June and walked in and said, look, I don't know all these things. If he hadn't made changes, we would give him the benefit of the doubt, right? We would basically say, okay, well, you don't know those things because you just started. But the fact is he's dramatically shifted the organization in serious ways that have led to a spike in mail delays. And for him not to be able to then answer those questions, it's like, what did you base the changes you made on if you don't know anything about the agency that you run?
Well, we should talk about strategy for a minute because we're both lawyers and spend time in the courtroom. And we think, both of us, that Katie Porter is very effective. Part of what made it effective is that she exposed the ignorance on the part of DeJoy. And I've been wondering, and I've been waiting to ask you this question, what if DeJoy actually did know the prices of the stamps and he did know the numbers of people who voted by mail? That's something that members of his staff, you would think, would have prepared him for, if not prepare himself as the head of the agency. If he had known the answers to those questions, would they have come off as sort of petty gotcha and made the whole session much less effective? How do you think about, you know, just as a pure
like Q&A, legal question,
you know, cross-examination?
Yeah, it's a great question.
Just a strategic question. You're thinking with your staff, you know what? I bet this buffoon doesn't know anything about the agency. I'm going to ask him the most simple questions about the prices of stamps. And you would think a member of the staff, I would have said, well, yeah, Congresswoman, that would be very effective. But, you know, maybe he does know. How's that going to look? What do you think?
So I think, look, we've seen her question a few times that I've really focused on. I haven't watched enough to know the sort of depth of her ability. So I want to, you know, sort of caution that. But now let me tell you what my immediate takeaway was. These are kind of questions of like, well, how much do you really know? Like, how connected are you really to the agency? And by the way, if he had answered 10 or 20 of these in a row, I used to do state legislative testimony on our budget. And, you know, the more questions you can answer correctly, the more people know, like, oh, they know their stuff and, you know, they sort of move on. So
And they lay off.
So she would have throttled back. But don't you think that, like, I think she had a bunch of lines of questions set up. And another one, which is this, you know, who basically the decision about cutting overtime. And that's a great example of like a cross-examination avenue, because at the end of the day, like, there's a direct correlation. He cuts overtime. Seniors are waiting. Like, there have been all these testimonials. There's data that shows the mail delays have gone up. There's all this anecdotal, testimonial, qualitative evidence that seniors are saying, I had to wait for my mail. I had to go put money out of my pocket instead of getting it through my health insurance because the mail didn't come in time. And so, you know, ultimately, that's a very winning line of argument. Here, it became really interesting because he was basically like, I didn't do it. I don't know who did it. So he looked completely incompetent. But there's another version that could have gone where he said, yeah, I authorize that because I think people are inefficient and I want them to be more efficient. So if I cut overtime, I think they're going to be more efficient. And then you go through cross-examining, like, you're willing essentially to have an 85-year-old person who needs heart medicine go without that medicine, and there's no other way you can improve the function of your agency. And by the way, what's your proof that this is that the overtime is what's causing the inefficiency? So I think it would have been a much more complicated train of cross-examination, but that, you know, there were a few points that are just really, the facts are irrefutable. And so, but again, I think I go back to my initial point of like, how prepared was she? Like, how able would she have been able to do that? But I think, I wonder if you agree with this, she knows how to ask the second and third question. Right?
And yeah, because she listens.
Yes.
She listens. I mean, questions are short. There's another example. We also previewed how we thought, I think we mentioned this, how AOC, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, would do. She doesn't have legal training. She gets mocked by Republicans for having been a bartender. I think she is one of the most effective questioners in the entire body.
Mr. DeJoy, you've received about $1.86 million in rental payments from your former company, XPO, correct?
Approximately, yes.
Have you taken any meetings with XPO Logistics since becoming Postmaster General?
I have not.
Have you emailed, texted, called, video conferenced, or communicated with your former company, XPO Logistics?
I have many friends at the company, and I've spoken to them casually over the last several months. Yes, I probably would have spoken to them.
Thank you.
She's like taking a deft deposition, and I mean that as a very high compliment. And she asked, she had, I think, mostly, you know, trained her fire on one topic, and that is meetings that DeJoy might have had with people from his former company because there's perhaps a conflict of interest. And she asked him repeated questions about his calendar, whether he keeps a calendar, who has access to the calendar, whether he will provide the calendar to the Congress. And it wasn't showy, but it actually has the effect of being, you know, kind of dramatic, because they're simple, focused questions getting to facts.
Yeah. And she pinned him down and he said, no, I won't provide it. And so again, when you put all of this together, he looks like I think were effective at making him look like he doesn't know what's happening at the agency, or he's lying about that. One of two things, either, which is bad. And he's not willing to provide the kind of transparency that the legislators are asking for, to know, like, look, what's really going on. Like, you say that you're going to be mindful of conflicts. You know, how often are you seeing these people? And I think that they both were very effective. I agree with you. Now, I guess we go back to the same point, though, which is he did his time. He went before the Congress. The House passed a bill basically called Delivering for America Act, asking for an additional $25 billion funding infusion for the post office. It sounds like McConnell will not take it up in the Senate. But the one thing that was interesting is that some Republican House members switched sides and voted for that bill. And that's something we have not been seeing a lot of. And so I think that...
Yeah, I think 2026, right?
Yes. That's not, and I think the post office...
Not a ton, but it's not small.
Yeah, everybody needs the post office. Everybody relies on the post office. And so I guess the question in my mind is, I guess there are three questions. One is, has he already done so much damage that there will be problems with voting? Two, does he stay true to his word and basically saying he's not going to make additional changes? And three, you know, will it be, if anything goes wrong, will it be too late by the time we find out?
So something else happened since we last taped. And I went in and did, I had to do it on my own because you were taking some well-deserved days off.
Thank you.
I taped 15 or 17 minutes about the indictment of Steve Bannon and three others, and I know it must have caused you some pain, even though you were enjoying your time with your family, it must have caused you some pain not to be able to weigh in on this craziness. So just to remind people very quickly, then I want to hear your take, because I spent a bunch of time reacting already. Steve Bannon and others arrested on one count of conspiracy to commit money laundering and one count of conspiracy to commit wire fraud in connection with this effort to raise money to build a wall on the southern border that Donald Trump has told us was going to be paid for by Mexico. So the whole thing is bizarre. And then Steve Bannon is arrested on a Chinese dissident's, you know, like $30 million yacht, this populist. It's kind of nutty. Do you have a reaction, Anne?
It's very nutty. Well, the first thing I'd say is I woke up to the news and I was less surprised than I would have expected myself to be. And I think that just goes to the fact that I don't know whether Bannon is the sixth or seventh member of the president's inner circle that's now been indicted and charged with crimes. But that is, I'm going to use it here, Preet. That's an extraordinary thing to have that level of people. Bannon ran the campaign for a period of time. He was the chief White House strategist. He has, you know, his reported net worth is very high. He's worth, you know, he has millions of dollars in assets and to his name. And so you see something like this, and I should be stunned by it. And yet, In some ways, I was not surprised at all. And we've talked about this on and off over the past 4 years, but it's like the president surrounded himself with almost grifters, a sort of high-end version of folks who are out to basically profit themselves personally. And, you know, they are furthering an agenda to some extent, but they're also really about themselves and their own personal gain, just like we could argue that's also true of the president. But to see it just in, and having read the indictment, I mean, this is, it's also worth it.
Seems strong to you, right?
It's really strong. It's really strong. And people probably know this because you and I talk about this a lot, but fraud cases that are paper cases where you have bank transfers and you have wires and you have text messages back and forth between people saying, like, keep this confidential, don't talk about this, like that, those cases are very, very hard to beat because it's not like where you have a witness, like in a he said, she said, right, where there's like one witness that says something, the other witness says no, you're relying on the jury believing your witness. But here, you don't need to believe the witnesses. You basically can follow both the money and the paper trail.
There's two things, right? It's strong and it's also simple.
Yes.
It's very easy to understand. They said over and over and over again, we're not going to take a penny, no salary, not going to take a penny, no salary. And then you have documents that show they took a lot of pennies. They took a lot of salary and they speak for themselves. And, you know, sometimes you have complicated frauds that involve, you know, technical accounting principles and how you monetize assets, et cetera, et cetera. And sometimes you have to have expert witnesses come in and testify about that. Everyone understands this was a charity. We said we wouldn't take a penny. We took $1 million or more. Case closed, right?
Yeah. I mean, and then you start to think about what are the possible defenses? I mean, one defense, which they, I think, will try is, well, he was entitled to a salary. Nobody, you know, it didn't impact whether or not people made the decision to give money to the charity. But we know that's not true. We know that there are, from the indictment, which is a lengthy indictment, right? It's a speaking indictment, meaning that the government wanted to put a lot of the facts out there so the public would understand what was happening and why. But it basically says that there were people who reached out and their contributions to the charity were contingent on believing that all their money was going to actually go toward building the wall and not toward salaries. And the bottom line is, if it didn't matter and he wanted to get a salary, they would have just said that. And if they were really, if they believe that that was the right way to approach this, to raise money, they would have done that. And they didn't do it. And they went out of their way. And, you know, Bannon is on record as saying this is a volunteer organization. So my question for you, Preet, is does Bannon cooperate? Because these are serious charges. They're simple, but they are, I think they're very strong.
You know, I don't know. I keep getting asked that question. And I'm sure you do. Every time there's a case like this, the question is, will someone flip? Will someone flip on the president? Roger Stone obviously did not. And may have received, you know, sort of in-kind benefit for that, the commutation of his sentence. Michael Cohen kind of tried to cooperate, and for various reasons, maybe he was considered unreliable or unworthy. SDNY did not sign him up as a formal cooperator. Steve Bannon is kind of a sketchy guy in various ways. He might have substantial assistance abilities with respect to some other business partners of his, with respect to an associate of Trump, with respect to his co-defendants. Remember, he's not the top defendant on the caption.
Right, Colfage's. Yep.
It's Colfage. And ordinarily, it's not always the case. He just is the most famous one. You will sometimes want the cooperation of people further down on the caption to cooperate against the people who are further up. I mean, I don't know. What do you think?
Well, I think the other piece is that, so I think Colfage, it's four defendants. He is the top defendant. And so Bannon and two other defendants are the lesser defendants. I think it's very likely one of those three cooperates. And so once you get to that point, if you're Bannon, you know that the likelihood of your conviction, I think, is very high. And so he's either got to gamble for a presidential pardon, which I think, of course, is possible here. We just saw it, obviously, with Roger Stone had his sentence commuted. I think it's possible that he takes that gamble. But this is different. The Stone piece, the Flynn piece, everything, the Manafort, like all that has relates. And again, the president's only so far done Stone, but it all relates to the president's narrative of the 2016 election was fine and the Mueller investigation was a witch hunt. And so it sort of fits into the president's public, you know, statements. This is very different, right? This is related to something the president was doing, but it doesn't, I think it's a lot harder for the president to get involved in this. Again, the president doesn't really see limits, but it just feels to me like a harder gamble. So then you get to the point of, you know, will he cooperate or not? And I think that there's a decent possibility that he does. And again, you know, it's hard to know this, but also, what do you make of this defense? I mean, one of the defenses, like the immediate defense is, this is politics. They're doing this to get back at President Trump. They don't like the wall, right? And that is essentially a really bizarre defense to walk into trial, which is basically saying, yeah, we broke laws, but they're only prosecuting us for politics.
It's a rhetorical defense, and people use it. They say it's a, you know, people will say it's a witch hunt. They're saying they don't like Donald Trump, and they're trying to get back at people who don't like Donald Trump. Steve Bannon is mouthing off against the SDNY and saying it's a political hit job.
This was to stop and intimidate people that want to talk about the wall. This is to stop and intimidate people that have President Trump's back on building the wall.
To my mind, I'm like, blah, blah, blah. Anyone who knows anything about the Southern District knows that that's not how it operates. It charges more Democrats than Republicans historically, certainly during my tenure there. I'm not sure how much you can even make that argument to a jury. This is something he's saying to the press because they don't have much other defense, it seems to me. I also think it hurts his ability to cooperate. You know, prosecutors are people. And if you're going to go around and crap on the motivations and the integrity of the prosecutors, it makes you a more volatile witness. You know, that stuff comes back to haunt you later if you're a witness for the prosecution. It also maybe signals that he's, take-no-prisoners guy. He referred to himself as a honey badger.
I am not going to back down. This is a political hit job. Everybody knows I love a fight. You know, I was called honey badger for many years. You know, honey badger doesn't give.
And I think he will find that the true honey badgers are the people in the U.S. Attorney's office.
I had to look up the honey badger reference.
Don't you know about the honey badger?
No, I didn't know about it. Have you explained it to our listeners?
I don't know that I'm trying to do it in a way that's rated G. The honey badger is famously one of the most fearless, perhaps stupidly fearless animals in the wild. And there's a viral video from a few years ago in which someone is playing the part of a honey badger who's speaking and basically saying, honey badger don't give a shit about anything. And we'll tangle with snakes, we'll tangle with stinging bees because a honey badger don't care. And Steve Bannon is likening himself to that honey badger. And, you know, people can talk a big game when they're out in the public and they're not being detained. Once you get in the courtroom, it's not so easy.
I agree. I also think that it's, you know, it's Bannon as the individual up against the institution of the government that has built this case against him. And
the deep state, and yeah, it's the deep state.
It's going to be very difficult to convince a jury of a lot of the things I think that they've sort of floated so far as their defense. The lead defendant, Brian Colfage, his defense, at least according to his wife, it feels like, and to him a little bit so far, is, you know, look, I had other money. So when I bought a luxury car, it's because I had a Range Rover that I traded in, which really just misses the whole point that if you stole money.
He got the $100,000 plus $20,000 a month that was concealed through pass-throughs and shell companies, some of which went to his wife to hide the payments. The fact that you had other fungible money with which you bought, you know, your toys and trinkets does not affect your guilt. And that's the thing. When you argue these things in the press, you can pick and choose what you want to argue about. But the fact remains, the government has to be held to its proof and these people are presumed innocent. But in my experience, you don't put an allegation, especially in the indictment, that you can't prove. There's going to be, and usually it's the case, by the way, it's almost always the case, that what you see in the indictment is the minimum of what they have. Their bank work clearly was extensive. There's a whole asset forfeiture section at the back of the indictment listing with specificity and bank account numbers, account after account after account. The U.S. Attorney's Office has seen all of this. The investigation goes back to at least October of 2019 and probably many months before that.
Yeah, and what do you make of the search warrants? I mean, it was reported that there were 5 or 6 search warrants that were also executed on that day. So
they're going to get more evidence.
They're going to get more evidence, yep.
A couple other things I want to get your reaction to. There is conflicting reporting about what Bill Barr knew about the case and when he knew it. Bill Barr himself has said, I was briefed on it a few months ago, which would indicate that he knew about it before Jeff Berman was removed, But then there's other reporting that says when Bill Barr said months ago, since Jeff Berman was removed 2 months ago, he didn't mean before that, and that he only found out about the case after. That actually comports with my sense of things. I've been asked the question, you know, was there any obligation on the part of the U.S. attorney in SDNY to get approval from the attorney general? And I cannot think of any. I mean, sometimes—
Yeah, on a fraud case?
I mean, when the relationship is decent and you're not worried about being interfered with, you know, you just give a heads up. But the only thing that makes this different from any other garden variety charity fraud that you and I have both prosecuted is the fact that one of the people is kind of a former associate of the president.
Yes. And so I think that these are great points. The times that that DOJ has to be notified, there are specific statutory requirements. There are DOJ rule requirements that basically say, you know, for example, in a human trafficking case, a local U.S. attorney's office could not indict a case without giving notice to the Department of Justice. And the reason was at that point in time, it was a very new law, and they wanted to make sure that it was correctly prosecuted and done in a fair, uniform way. Terrorism, obviously, is something you would not prosecute without notice and approval to the Department of Justice. But most cases, you do not have to give approval to the Department of Justice. And so I agree completely. It's a garden variety fraud case, and it's a pretty straightforward fraud case. The only difference here is Bannon, and I suspect it was probably done, I don't know this, I have zero inside knowledge, but I suspect it was more like, look, we're investigating this guy, Brian Colfage. We believe he may be associated in some way with Steve Bannon, and there are a number of other individuals. We're looking at all of these folks, like just as the, like not in the weeds of the investigation, but as the, we don't want you to be surprised if something leaks, or if we, you know, get to a point where we're going to return an indictment. So we're going to give you a little bit of knowledge. And then what I wanted to ask you about is the public reporting is really interesting because, as you and I both know, you can go into a grand jury, ask for an indictment to be returned, and do it under seal, meaning that it's not public yet. And then at some point, you unseal that indictment, and then it becomes public. And so there are a variety of reasons that you would have a sealed indictment and that it wouldn't be unsealed until you're ready to be public. But here, it's clear that they gave, it looks like from the public reporting, that they gave notice to Barr last Thursday when the charges came down that they were about to announce the indictment, that it was about to be unsealed, which means they'd already done the grand jury, which means he couldn't have really walked it back. Does that comport with your feeling about it?
I just want to be careful because I don't know, because SDNY doesn't leak and talk about these things, what the communications were, when they took place, how detailed they were. But look, I think this is an unfortunate thing, right? You want it to be the case that a local U.S. attorney, and by the way, U.S. attorneys, for the most part, not recently, are independently confirmed by the Senate. Yes, they are within the auspices of the Justice Department, but they have an independent aspect to their tenure as well. They're not supposed to go rogue and do nutty things and violate policies and direct orders. And I never did, but I also felt it important to exercise my own independent judgment as the leader of that office, accountable to the public in my district also. And if you have an attorney general who again and again and again seems to have interfered with only one kind of case, cases that involve associates of the president like Roger Stone and Michael Flynn, you might think twice about overindulging notifications to the Justice Department. And some people may find that controversial, but there was no policy violated if notice wasn't given, as you have said. And when you have something like the track record of Bill Barr, maybe you don't go above and beyond the call of duty and tell him about everything you're doing because of what you've seen him do before.
And look, even if, I mean, it's not clear to me when Barr was given that first heads up, whether it was before or after Berman left. But remember, we said at the time that Berman was pushed out that, you know, it could be an investigation related to what we know about is happening. Things like Rudy Giuliani, that it's been publicly reported, is, you know, been the subject of investigative steps by the Southern District. But it also could be something that we had no idea was coming. And this sort of falls into that later bucket. So whether or not it happened before or after Berman was removed, I think given Berman's removal. So even if they gave Barr notice after, when you think about Berman's removal, remember they tried to put in, you know, a civil lawyer from the SEC. It was never clear why the timing was what it was. They were trying to, in the interim, put in a loyalist, the New Jersey U.S. attorney. So it smelled really badly. So all of those reasons are reasons for the woman, Audrey Strauss, who's the acting head of the Southern District, for her basically to be incredibly cautious with Barr and frankly, distrustful, to assume that a bad result could happen if she wasn't cautious. And so to really play it straight down the road and not let Barr interfere.
Can we talk about the victims for a second? Because, I put out a tweet when we put out the special episode last week in which I said, look, regular people were hurt by this fraud. And as you pointed out, the indictment says, look, there are some folks that didn't have a lot of money and they had to be induced into giving money to this cause. Whatever you think about this cause, and you and I might have a particular view that's different from the victim's view about building a wall. And we've gotten a couple of responses by Twitter that I'll read and we should address. Twitter user HiSierra6100 writes, quote, I have a hard time feeling sorry for the MAGAs that lost their money. Anyone with an IQ above room temperature understands that Trump surrounds himself with grifters, yet they choose to support him and in this case send money, end quote. Here's another one from Twitter user IA Snowflake, good name. Quote, no, they aren't regular people. They are racists who fell victim to their own ignorance and nastiness. They exploit the circumstances of immigrants and were exploited in return. Sounds like karma to me, end quote. Now, you and I have prosecuted frauds where you have, you know, gullible victims. It happens all the time. And on the one hand, it is bizarre, right, that this thing that Mexico is supposed to pay for, that is the responsibility of the federal government, that in a week, this is maybe also one of the things that sparked the fraud.
$17 million. Yeah.
$17 million buckaroos.
Yeah.
Can I say buckaroos?
Of course.
In a week. And maybe, look, this is not an excuse. They thought, holy crap, we're getting a lot of money. Why can't we skim some off the top? It's a little bit insane, thinking about it just as a casual observer, that there are people in small amounts who would give so much money for building this wall on the southern border. I bet many of whom don't even live along the southern border. So there's something, you know, bizarre about that, you know, the depth of feeling about having a border wall, which many people think is just not effective and causes all sorts of other problems. Even when the president that you support has failed, now we're going to take private money to do this. So on the one hand, that is true. But on the other hand, victims are victims.
As the victims are victims part, because we can completely disagree on the goal of the organization to build the border wall. It's also, let's just step aside and say, it's really bizarre. The government could not accept that private money, which is why they ended up building a private section of the wall that's less than 5 miles and is apparently falling into the river. And so the whole thing turns out to be a disaster. But again, you know, so the whole thing, like the whole construct is just really, like, I think it was meant as like probably a political way to sort of garner some support. And then all of a sudden, all this money came in and it's like, wow, we could actually, you know, try to use this money in part to build a part of a wall and also to line our personal bank accounts and enrich ourselves. But when it comes to the victim piece, you know, I think, and there've already been some of this, and there's already been some of this in the news, which is people saying, like, I would have given the money anyway, right? Like, I don't care. Those guys deserve to make a little money. And so there's a little bit of this idea is going to be, you know, people are going to push these people really weren't victims. But the bottom line is, when someone makes a material representation saying, we are going to take 100% of what you give and give it to the wall, and then they lie and they cheat and they steal, that's a violation of the law, regardless of what the underlying purpose is, regardless of whether or not you think that people should have known better. And, you know, one of the victims here was a 7-year-old kid who clearly, like, you know, thought, I'm contributing to something I believe in. And we can disagree with what he believed in, but the idea that his money would be taken so Steve Bannon can sit on a yacht or, you know, buy a car or, you know, Kofaj can put money down on jewelry and plastic surgery. Like, it's really, to me, we can't get to the point where we discount victims because of their political beliefs. And so I feel pretty strongly about that, just as I feel like there's nothing to be, you know, someone asked me the other day, like, you know, I'm really happy about the Bannon thing. Is that wrong? And I said, look, you know, for me as a former prosecutor, and you probably feel the same way, it's about the law and the facts. And look, I wasn't surprised in many ways. I'm always disappointed. I'm always a little bit shocked that people risk you know, spending 20 or 40 years in jail to basically, you know, steal amounts of money to people to buy luxury cars. Like the Colfage had a Range Rover, and was that not good enough for him? He needed more. I mean, there's a greed to this that's always a bit.
It's very hard to understand why some people who have a lot of money commit fraud when they don't need the money. It's also, by the way, sometimes the case that people who look like they have money don't. That it's all, you know,
smoke and mirrors, right? Yes.
That's happened with wealthy people before, you know, people that we prosecuted that I write about in my book. I don't know if that's true with these folks. But we should also just make clear, and it's implicit in what we've been saying, the allegation is not that all $25 million was blown on, you know, personal toys for the defendants. A lot of the money was used, but a significant portion of it was pocketed. And in the face of representations that not a penny would be pocketed, that's the fraud. So there's some, you know, there's some wiggle room. I don't think effective wiggle room, but there's some wiggle room for the defendants to say, look, here's what this money did. We applied this money to do all these things and to get construction materials and everything else. That misses the point. And so prosecutors will have to, you know, really home in on that.
I agree. That's going to be a key part of the trial. So Preet, as we sort of get toward the election and it's coming quickly, there was news in John Durham, the Connecticut U.S. Attorney's probe. You remember that Bill Barr started this some time ago, saying he wanted to look into the origins of the 2016 investigation into the Trump campaign and the FISA that was brought against Carter Page initially as part of what turned into the FBI's intelligence investigation, later turned into a criminal investigation. But last week, we had one of the first developments where one of the FBI lawyers, and this was reported over a year ago in the Inspector General's report, but one of the FBI lawyers basically was charged with and pled guilty to altering an email related to, I think it was the fourth FISA application when they were trying to renew the FISA application on Carter Page. And so what do you make of this? Is this evidence of more like serious wrongdoing? Like how should we be thinking about this in the context of the Durham probe and the president and Barr's attack on the 2016 investigation into the Trump campaign?
Yeah. So look, it's not good. Kevin Kleinsmith not only was accused of committing a crime, he decided to plead guilty to it. And the standard that we have always talked about, whether it's Michael Flynn or any other case, is if you accept responsibility and you are prepared to allocute, meaning confess what you did in your own words, and the judge accepts the guilty plea, as was done here, it's a crime. And a crime is quite serious no matter what. But if you're a law enforcement official, he wasn't an FBI agent, but a lawyer within the Federal Bureau of Investigation, that's a bad thing. And he had no excuse for passing along what looked like an email from another party over to a supervisory special agent. And he added a phrase that was not in the original communication. In fairness to him, meaning the defendant Kleinsmith, he says that the thing he added comports with his understanding of the facts, which is that Carter Page was not a source for the CIA. There's some controversy about that and some disagreement about that. But it is true that he altered the document. This doesn't mitigate the fact that he's guilty of making a false statement. But Kleinsmith does says, quote, at the time, I believe that the information I was providing in the email was accurate, but I am agreeing that the information I inserted into the email was not originally there, and I inserted that information. So bad, crime, yes, acknowledged and pled guilty to, not pleaded guilty to, but pled guilty to in my mind. The things that are important with respect to the whole broad question that you asked and that people consider, this was not the original Carter Page FISA application. This was, I think, the fourth one on June 15th or so of 2017. There was no finding in connection with this case or on the part of the Inspector General that there was something decidedly wrong with the origins of the Russia case. We'll see if John Durham has something more to say about that. So there's nothing in this thing that shows that there was a broader conspiracy to do something bad. This was terrible judgment and, in fact, felonious conduct on the part of an individual lawyer at the FBI, not to be minimized, but also not to be overstated.
Yeah, I guess I would add two things. The first is that it feels to me hard for anyone to argue that this undercuts the 2016 investigation of the president's campaign. Remember, Mueller's investigation led to a number of charges against Russian individuals for interfering in the 2016 election, as well as some of Trump's associates. But what's important here is that this representation, this email, went to Carter Page, who was never charged, and really goes nowhere as part of that investigation, either the investigation of the Trump Organization campaign or of the administration and the actions of the Russians and the president. And so I think it's important to know, like, this is basically a road to nowhere. It's an indication of something that happened with regard to a FISA application that should not have happened. I agree with you completely. This was terrible judgment. I want to just sort of say, it's not so clear to me that the allocution, the quote you just read from Kleinsmith, is really admission of a crime. It's a little bit complicated. And so do I think the conduct was terrible? The answer is yes. But I think it's also important to note he had turned over all the underlying CIA materials. He was just, you know, this was sort of like the email that he put on the top where he said, to the best of my recollection, blah, blah, blah. And then he doctored the part from the CIA. He inserted not a source. And that was his view of the materials. That wasn't actually what the CIA had said. And so that is a serious misrepresentation. And it is really a problem. The real sort of wrong here is in, he could have written just a sentence at the top that said, look, I don't think he was a source. And the reason this is important is that if Carter Page was actually a source for the CIA, it sort of undercuts this argument that he was a source or an asset for the Russians, right? If he's working for the U.S., it's sort of hard to believe he's working for the Russians.
That's the whole point. That's why it's important. I agree. Now, with respect to the overall Durham investigation, a couple of troubling things. About a week and a half ago, the AG, Bill Barr, said on the Sean Hannity show,
and I've said there are going to be developments, significant developments, before the election, but we're not doing this on the election schedule. We're aware of the election. We're not going to do anything inappropriate before the election, but we're not being dictated to by this schedule. What's dictating the timing of this are developments in the case, and there will be developments.
Which is worrisome on its own, but it's particularly worrisome when you have the President of the United States sort of goading him on and hoping that there will be some revelation that's helpful to the president's election prospects on the eve of the election, which is only 70 some odd days away. Trump said to reporters about 10 days ago, quote, Bill Barr has a chance to be the greatest of all time, but if he wants to be politically correct, he'll just be another guy.
Yeah, so he's taunting him to basically say, bring charges, bring charges. This whole idea that they would bring charges now before an election, it's really troubling to me. And just, you know, again, we're really just right up, unless we see it within the next week, but sort of Labor Day is the sort of, you know, September 1st after Labor Day is sort of the unofficial time that anything that would impact an election shouldn't be happening. And so within the federal government, and again, you know, you can't control the states and the locals, but the federal government has, you know, a longstanding norm that they don't want to influence the outcome of an election.
I mean, it's a guideline.
It's a guideline.
I just want to make clear.
Yeah, it's a norm.
There are things that happen and that have to happen and that are actually worthwhile happening, but you take the clock of an election very, very seriously, and you at least subject yourself to the norm that if you violate it, you know, you have to have a really good reason. To the contrary, in this case, they're kind of like boasting about the idea that they're going to do something significant before an election. It's not like, oh, you know, our hands are tied. There's a statute of limitations problem.
Right. Or, that would be, you know, an exception. That's a great example.
No, they're boasting about, yeah, guess what? We got a lot of stuff coming and it's going to happen before the election.
Well,
sorry,
what's also
like it or not.
Troubling is that this relates to the last election. So it is so clearly being engineered, in my view, to relate to the president and this next election. And again, the president has had a 4-year campaign of saying, I've been wrongfully accused. I didn't do anything wrong. I've been targeted. I'm the victim. And so to step into that, if John Durham does that, I mean, he basically, in my view, has zero integrity, because there is no reason why, and I've said this before, and I'll probably say it a million times before November, there's no reason why this can't wait till the middle of November, unless it's something like you're saying, which is the statute is going to run. But to me, that's an argument. You're John Durham, you make sure you get everything in before you come close to an election. And so, you know, that would just be, you almost move the statute up 3 months in your investigation. So, you know, this is the drop dead date that we have to figure out whether we have a case or not. The other piece just to note is that I sort of feel like, from having followed what's been happening with Durham and with Barr, it almost looks to me like they're pointing at the CIA and the Kleinsmith piece. And I could be completely wrong on this, but that, you know, it sort of felt like they were looking at the FBI. The only sort of allegation they've come up with, and again, we already knew this from the Inspector General's report, was this you know, terrible thing that was done by the FBI lawyer with this misrepresentation in an email that was used to get authorization for a FISA that ultimately doesn't lead anywhere, but still was wrong. And, you know, he pled guilty to the crime. But there does feel to me like the overall vibe of this is the CIA was after the president. They were trying to sort of gin up and trick the FBI into basically going up on Page, starting this investigation, and that the FBI took the bait. I could be wrong on that, but I feel like as we watch the Durham stuff, like that's my eyes sort of peeled to what's going to happen related to that.
All right. So before we end, we got a lot of legal news this weekend while you were taking some days off. Two quick things. We should address, you know, this continuing saga of Cy Vance trying to get financial material relating to the president, which went up to the Supreme Court, went back down to the district court judge. That has advanced a little bit, right?
Yeah. I mean, the district court judge said Cy Vance gets the materials. There's no basis for these arguments being made by the president. What does the president's lawyer turn around and do? He immediately says, we're appealing. This is wrong. And so he's essentially relitigating everything. I think it's going to be heard by the appeals court on September 1st. Vance has agreed not to enforce the subpoena until then. That's next week, obviously. But I fully expect that the president is not going to win this. But again, he's playing a game of process, which is, you know, he gets the chance to appeal this. He wants to appeal it. And the one thing I'd note is that the trial judge, Judge Marrero, he wrote a lengthy opinion. And so he anticipated this. And I think we'll quickly see it, you know, go up and come back and that Cy Vance will get the materials. But it's yet another, it's another delay.
And then there was another announcement, I guess surprised some folks, timed oddly and interestingly, depending on your perspective, for the first day of the Republican National Convention, the New York Attorney General Letitia James asked a judge to order Eric Trump, younger son of the President of the United States, to provide testimony under oath and to hand over documents from the Trump Organization about various properties they're investigating, relating to, as I understand it, the possibility that assets were inflated for the purposes of getting loans from banks. And that's something that I think Cy Vance also suggested he was looking at, and something that came up in congressional testimony as well.
I mean, I think the first point is what's interesting to me is that this is clearly, at least has been publicly reported in the last couple months, part of the Vance investigation. Vance, to me, has clear jurisdiction, though I think the New York AG may have jurisdiction over this, but it's, you know, it feels to me like it's part of what Vance is already doing. We don't know that. I would hope that Vance and the New York AG have had this conversation. But the second thing is that I just didn't like the timing. And so it doesn't surprise me at all that the New York AG would look into this. It was reported, there was a great podcast, a ProPublica article about the sort of delta between the sort of discrepancy between Trump was saying, you know, he had a ton of assets when he went to get a loan. And when it came to paying taxes, he was saying, you know, I don't have a lot of assets. So he was changing what his income and assets were according to the reporting. And so that is certainly a space that you would investigate and look at. But the timing, I don't know how you feel about it, but it's like,
well, in fairness to her, as I understand the reporting, apparently Eric Trump was supposed to come for an interview voluntarily under oath last month. And I didn't know that, and that didn't leak out. And then he abruptly canceled that meeting and said, we can't go forward.
It's more complicated than just canceling the meeting, too, because it looks like he invoked his Fifth Amendment right.
Right. Although people don't like to use the number five.
Right. I understand that, but let's be
the lawyer said we should quote the lawyer. The lawyer said, quote, we cannot allow the requested interview to go forward pursuant to those rights afforded to every individual under the Constitution, end quote. And it may be that one reason he didn't want to say the Fifth Amendment, which is obviously what he's referring to, is so as not to endure the ire of his father, the president, who on one occasion famously said,
like you see on the mob, right? You see the mob takes the Fifth. If you're innocent, why are you taking the Fifth Amendment?
And maybe Eric, you know, wants to continue to receive love such as it is from his father. I mean, I'm joking, obviously.
Yeah, look, I mean, I think what's most fascinating about this whole situation to me is that, you know, he's agrees to come in. His lawyer sends a letter basically not saying directly, I'm taking five, but basically saying, I'm going to take the Fifth Amendment. I'm not going to testify because something I say may be used against me in a court of law. And that applies in the criminal context. It does not apply in the civil context. And it also does not apply for an organization. Like the Trump Organization cannot take the Fifth Amendment. So it really applies to him individually. That's interesting. Now, what's interesting about the AG going in to compel him is that you know, what she's basically going to do is force Eric Trump to say, I have a Fifth Amendment right not to answer the following questions, right? So she's pushing on that because, again, you know, assuming her investigation is criminal and the New York AG has limited criminal jurisdiction, if it's civil, she has a much easier time of compelling him to answer. But, you know, there are a lot of pieces here that I think are pretty interesting. And again, you know, my only caveat on the timing is like, we live in such a hyper-politicized world that investigations, particularly serious investigations as to whether or not there was fraud, I don't like anybody having the argument that they're being politicized. And so it's not even the substance of it so much as I worry a lot that we've come to a point where people feel like everything is being politicized.
All right, Anne, so a lot of news this week. I predict there will be a lot of news for next week too. Get some rest. Try not to go crazy watching too much of this convention.
You too. And I'll talk to you very soon. Please send us your questions and we'll try our best to answer them.
Send them to letters@cafe.com.
Take care.
That's it for this week's Insider Podcast. Your hosts are Preet Bharara and Anne Milgram. The executive producer is Tamara Sepper. The senior producer is Adam Waller. The senior audio producer is David Tatasciore. And the Cafe team is Matthew Billy, Nat Wiener, Sam Ozer-Staten, David Kurlander, Noah Azulai, Jake Kaplan, Calvin Lord, Jeff Eisenman, Chris Boylan, Sean Walsh, and Margot Malley. Our music is by Andrew Dost. Thank you for being a part of the Cafe Insider community.